It's not so much that he's criminal. It's that he's an idiot.
This is the new face of the Bush administration, Mark. It used
they
to be.
Don't even know when to steal the money that they need to run.
It used to be Jeff Gannon. Now it's this dude.
Oh, 22-year-old man whose vice president was a licensed masseur.
I love that bit.
The fledgling company, led by a 22-year-old man whose vice president was a licensed masseur. Well, maybe it was Jeff Gannon.
Unmarked
office in Miami.
Please, Jesus, Moses, Muhammad, Buddha, somebody. Somebody let a real
journalist. Police forces. Main supplier.
Yeah, please, let somebody ask Dana Perineal about this. Please. I'm begging.
Oh, my God.
No, better yet, please let somebody ask George Bush about this.
More than 40 years old and in decomposing packaging from aging stockpiles of the communist bloc. 22-year-old Ephraim Divaroli. Divaroli.
It's enough to do your head in, isn't it, Mark?
And David M. Pacuz. Problems in high school forced him to work through most of his teenager years, but he's a super nice guy.
But, like, you know, I've got a good attitude about that.
Oh, my God.
It is very, very seldom...
Oh, my God.
...that I get to do this. John Fox, write the date down. We have rendered Mark Levine speechless.
And we coaxed him in with Moses on bagels. That's even the best part of it.
Like just dragging it on a string through the forest.
Experience in arms procurement, but his dealings with the Albanian government were corrupt. Divaroli says, quote, he can't play monkey business with the mafia and all those effing guys in Albania.
That was my response, Mark.
Well, where's my $300 million?
Yeah, I know.
Where is my $300 million?
I'm going as soon as John is off the air. I'm putting tank. Putting a submarine up on Craigslist.
And then funding the horn and paying all our salaries.
Damn right. Enough of this BS.
He's in my extended network.
They got internet in Brazil, and I can buy it, and it's the same freaking time zone.
He likes to eat good food. He likes American Beauty.
Schindler's List is one of his favorite movies.
Yeah, also including Blow and Scarface.
Blow, Scarface, and Schindler's List.
Yeah, well, they have so much in common. Well, you know, he's obviously very good at what he does.
Whatever the hell that is.
I think he's sleeping with somebody.
For $300 million, he could pay to sleep with
some
a lot of people.
With that Spitzer prostitute.
For $300 million, he can sleep with Elliot Spitzer. I mean, Jesus.
That's right. He's a pimp. Oh, my God. Who paid him $300 million? And of course, Henry Waxman's all over it.
The Bush Pentagon. The Bush Pentagon.
They can't tell you. You know why? State secret.
National security.
Why did we give a 22-year-old Divaroli college, high school dropout $300 million to give ammunition? It's state secret.
This guy is so gonna get his movie rights bought.
Oh my God!
How much was that chip spill for? Just curious.
That what?
You know,
The chip spill.
The chip spill. How much was that
for?
Oh,
I think $40 billion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it was substantial. It's still, you know, a tenth of it's about a month of Iraq. Yeah.
I hate to break this up, but John's got to do a show.
All right.
You're not going to sleep well now.
No, I'm not.
I
want my $300 million.
I suggest a quick elixir of Mr. John Daniel.
Oh, God. Jack, take me home. Jack, take me away.
Home to Lynchburg, Jack. Baby. Home to Lynchburg.
Mr. Daniels, please! Yeah, I'm going to go make love to Mr. Daniels right now.
Yeah, and you know, bash your head into a wall, into the side of the wall while you drink, bash, drink, bash.
He's such a dude. I mean, he's like, he's not even...
The man has not ever even been in the hair care products aisle of Walmart, okay?
I mean, he could at least be the Bush's...
For $300 million, get the damn Armani suit, okay?
Yeah, he's in a T-shirt! The guy's in a T-shirt!
And his neck is thicker than my thigh.
He's got a fat neck.
Well, that's because he loves football, dude.
I guess.
I'm thinking tequila.
I'm glad you've been as disturbed as I, Mark.
You're going John Daniels. I'm going tequila.
Oh my God! All right.
I'm going to do the Pee Wee Herman dance because
I really am stunned. I thought the 24-year-old they put in charge of the stock market, who was busy with doing the flat tax in Iraq, and putting it all up on a board. I thought he was the one, but no. This takes the cake. Oh my God. There's an audio recording.
Oh, yeah, don't click away from that. You really want to hear the audio.
Well, but it's in another language.
No, but he's on it.
In English?
Dude does not speak Albanian.
No, he doesn't speak Albanian. So what the... Is this in English? Have you played this?
No, but it comes highly recommended.
Oh, wait, I can't do two things or twice. All right, I'm sorry. John, you do your show. I'm going to be watching some Albanian TV.
All right.
See you, Mark.
Show.
Sorry to do that to you.
All right, man, thank you.
Yeah, way to ruin my weekend. But, okay.
Yeah.
Jack will make it better. Jack always makes it better.
Everything goes better with Jack.
All right, I'm getting off the horn. Goodbye, folks.
Goodbye, cruel world. See you, Mark. Almost feel guilty doing that to him.
Ah, but it was funny.
I'm hanging on to this story. Which member of the horn can we next render speechless? Certainly
that
work
guy's
for.
Not on tomorrow.
Certainly, yeah, but I don't know. We'll just maybe ELO can drop it in his lap on Tuesday.
Yeah, in case he missed it. Too funny. I think it's time for Lowell, mate.
Yeah, I think it is. Sorry, didn't mean to run over on you there, brother.
That's all right. It was worth it.
This one really was, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
See you on the other side. And now, before we all come unglued, here's the late, great Lowell George, especially tonight, reminding you to...
What we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board. 11,
oh,
11,
and most of
11, and
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up,
yeah.
All the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show, right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366. Or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody. Welcome aboard to Foxed Up for a Thursday night, Friday morning, Friday afternoon, depending on where you are on this beautiful blue marble, such as it still is. And, yeah, we're starting a little bit late, but when you have, when you're able to just catch Mark Levine out like that and completely throw him to where he's got to go running for the Jack Daniels bottle because of a dude who gets $300 million from the federal government to go trade in old Soviet-era arms to our own troops, you just got to hold the phone for a little while. That has got to be one of the most insane stories that I've ever heard, and if you're just tuning in, just go to Raw Story and check it out. It's just the most insane thing I have heard in a long time. Oh, my. Well, it's Thursday night, folks, and you know what Thursday night means. That means it's Billy Shear's Music Night, and tonight we have part three of Lennon on Lennon, and this has been a great series so far, and we got a bunch of other stuff to get to. So since we started late, I'm not going to do all that much setup, but as you know, you have to check out Mr. Billy Shear's on Saturday nights here, 9 to midnight Eastern Time. With Night Sounds, check him out at BillyShearsMusic.com, our good friend who comes up with this amazing archive footage to put these pieces together. So without further ado, part three of Lennon on Lennon. Roll it, Bob.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
This is part three of Lennon on Lennon, Blame It on Bermuda. Now let's continue with the creative process and taping sessions of Double Fantasy. By all accounts, the making of Double Fantasy is a wonderful experience for John. Listening to the tapes of these sessions, we can feel the sense of celebration and positivity. But, as with any recording session, there is a lot of setting up and waiting. And, every once in a while, John and the band would start jamming. Now, this little breakout jam that we're about to hear is significant because it prefaces and highlights the importance of the first track on Double Fantasy, Starting Over.
Well, Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean maybe. Bebopalula, she, my baby love. Well, she's the woman that's got that beat. She's the woman with the flying feet. She's the one woman that I know. She's the woman that let me so say, Bebopalula, she's...
As you can hear, John loves the music of the 50s and captures that feeling in Starting Over. He picks it as the album's first single, a decision that comes easily to John.
Everybody loves the Down to the Bee, don't they?
It was obvious because it was the one where the musicians got very loose because it was so simple rock and roll, there was no problem. They really relaxed and they'd all be like that after it. Even though I don't think it's the strongest track, perhaps, some of the other tracks are stronger, like Losing You. Mm-hmm. Might be a stronger piece of material. But Starting Over was the best way to start over. And to me, it was like going back to 15 and singing a la Presley. All the time I was referring to John, the engineers here in the room with us, I was referring to it as Elvis Orbison, Only the Lonely. Like that. It's a kind of parody, but not really a parody.
A little tongue-in-cheek?
A little, okay. Well, when I was doing it, I was cracking up. Mm-hmm. It's been so long since they took a pop. You know,
he was winking, yeah.
I've had tongue-in-cheek all along. I'm the walrus. Mm-hmm. All of them had tongue-in-cheek. Just because other people see depths of whatever in it, what does it really mean? I am the Eggman, you know. It could have been the pudding basin for all I care. Just tongue-in-cheek.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. I know time flies so quickly.
The musical inspiration for Starting Over returns to the 50s, I'm Losing You goes back even farther. Once again, the song was written in Bermuda and put down on tape by John accompanying himself on acoustic guitar. Was in Bermuda. In New York, as John starts working out the arrangement with the band in the studio, the style changes. Final mix. Next week, part four of Lennon on Lennon, Blame It on Bermuda. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Thank you, Billy Shears. Looking forward to part four. Where you get this stuff, I have no idea, and honestly, I don't think I really want to know. But thanks again, mate, and like I said, don't forget Mr. Billy Shears and Night Sounds from 9 to midnight Eastern Time, Saturdays, here on the Head On Radio Network. And I can't believe this has slipped by me all week. I have somehow forgotten to remind everyone, and thanks to Gene for poking me about this, that Saturday night is Earth Hour. Now, this little event started here in little old Sydney last year, and it's now spread to some 35 nations, where on Saturday night, from 8 to 9 p.m., people in their homes, their public places, landmarks, will all shut down all their lighting for an hour as a symbol of the fight against global warming. And if you have that, if you have a telescope somewhere buried away from when you were a kid, that's the night to pull it out, because you might actually be able to see the stars for once if you live near a metropolitan area, because the light pollution should be reduced. And I'm not exactly sure why, and Betsy sent me this, but Tel Aviv held their Earth Hour last night. And it was rated a huge success. Some 40,000 residents of Tel Aviv gathered Thursday evening in Rabin Square to participate in Earth Hour, an international event intended to raise environmental consciousness by encouraging residents to turn their lights off and anything that uses electricity for an hour beginning at 8 p.m. The event was attended by President Shimon Peres, and who led the countdown from the roof of Tel Aviv's Azrieli Tower. Pardon me. The event was termed as a great success by the Tel Aviv municipality. The municipality went on to say that the electricity savings during the event exceeded the total saved energy in the city of Sydney during last year's event. Tel Aviv is one of 24 major world cities to participate in the annual event. Fair enough, but everyone else knows about it because Sydney gave it a go last year. And I imagine that we will see a whole bunch more lights go out this year. I recently got a really nice reflector telescope for a whopping $27 on eBay. And so I think Gail and I will be having some fun with that. Last year, we went around and kind of played Earth Hour police a little bit and went walking around the neighborhood to see just how many people were taking part. And it wasn't as, you know, big. It wasn't, at least in our area, not as many people took part as we had hoped. But I'll tell you, it was really kind of neat to just shut everything down, light some candles, and experience what it's like to not use any energy for an hour. It was beautifully peaceful, and it should be huge this year. In fact, down at Sydney Harbour, there's going to be a concert at candlelight during the hour, which I think will probably be very neat for those in attendance. So take part. It's a groovy thing. And, you know, it's this kind of event, you know, it's not going to save the world. And that's not the point. It is a symbolic event. And cities around the world who understand how important taking care of our environment and conservation are, take this hour out. In fact, I think most of the TV networks here are going to go dark aside from their, you know, transmitter. So their production facilities and all will just, you know, will go as dark as they possibly can. So anyway, Earth Hour, Saturday. And I reckon we'll see this thing get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger every single year. So, a lot of you's got a link in the chat room, www.earthhours.org. and check it out. I guess that's a list of all the many nations that are and cities that are taking part. And Nanette will be dark, and I bet it'll be awesome in places like West Virginia where the population isn't so dense. And, you know, all it'll take is a few of your neighbors actually going dark, and you might actually be able to see the Milky Way anyway. You know, I haven't seen the Milky Way in, at least 10 years. I mean, the light pollution in Sydney is just atrocious. The light pollution around my house is awful, but that's a whole other story. So I guess it, you know, it's kind of all right. You know, this actually, it'll be all over by the time, at least Eastern time, when Billy Shears is on. So, you know, I guess you can get away with, you know, if you got a laptop, run it on battery power for that hour if you need to listen to Mr. Billy Shears. So we haven't really coordinated anything to deal with that in the network. Maybe we'll have to do something next year, Bob. So, yeah. And it was fun last year. It was fun. And the Chaser guys actually had quite a good time because they went to the then liberal environmental minister's house and saw that his exterior lighting was still going. And so he comes out. He's like, what are you guys doing here? He goes, well, it's Earth Hour, you environmental minister, you. And he's like, oh, this is all security lighting. You know, I got a guest coming. Can't have him tripping and falling over. Well, if you have a guest coming over, you should have told him to bring a flashlight because it was Earth Hour. You know, pull out your cigarette lighter and find your way to the gate. But hey. Now, Betsy and Jean pretty much programmed this show today. Just so you know. From Betsy, who also sent me the post about Austin's I'm getting all these things. How do I listen to Billy Shears with my modem off? I don't know. But at least shut off all your lights and listen in candlelight. It's a hard call for that, and at least it doesn't interfere with my time zone. But anyway, just as Betsy sent that great article about the Austin Power Utility, who's got all these great kickbacks for people who want to install solar power, Southern California Edison wants to cover California rooftops with solar panels. See, this is all just getting to be good business. The power generation industry is seeing the inevitable, that burning coal is going to become too expensive to be viable. So here's what's happening there. And this is from Engadget.com. We've seen a few massive solar farms pop up out west, but it looks like Southern California Edison is taking a different approach. Instead of cluttering up the desert, the company plans to build a distributed solar array on the rooftops of commercial buildings throughout Southern California. Microgeneration! How long have I been talking about this? This is microgeneration, right here. On a slightly larger scale, but it's localized microgeneration. The plan is to spend $875 million over 5 years to cover about 2 square miles of rooftop with panels, which will alleviate stress on the grid by generating around 250 megawatts of juice, as much as a small power plant. That's enough to light up 162,000 homes. But it's still a little short of the record 280 megawatt Solana installation planned in Arizona. Come on, Cali, let's see a little fight, and I couldn't agree more. And I think the Solana installation is actually a solar geothermal installation, which, as you all know, I am a big, 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 big fan of solar geothermal. So, yeah. I'm digging it. See, the power utilities are catching on. They're figuring this out. They see the writing on the wall. And the time is now to start planning for the future. And they're saying, hey, wow, free energy, cool. And, you know, if you ran a big commercial business and the power utility came up to you and said, hey, we want to put solar panels on your building so that you get free power, and we feed the grid. What do you reckon? Do you think any business owner is going to turn that down? Hell no. They're going to be like, yeah, come on, buddy. So anyway, we got some other stuff to get into, but I usually don't do a track on the show when I have Billy Shear's music, but I've been kind of doing a bit of an Australian music thing, and I figured I'd keep that going, and I've been kind of doing the filibobster routine lately and just going straight through the hour. So I figure we're going to take a little break here and play one of my old bosses, actually, a singer-songwriter, Richard Clapton, known by his friends as Ralph, great songwriter, great arranger, still going strong, still writing music, but I figured I'd play this one because it's a great song, and I think that this is one of those tracks that would be a great replacement for Advance Australia Fair as an Australian national anthem. It's a little tongue-in-cheek. So Down in the Lucky Country, you can find this on the Definitive Anthology from Richard Clapton, which is a great two-disc set. If you like your kind of 70s, well-produced singer-songwriter rock and roll with great studio-esque bands, this guy will, you know, just work for you. So a good friend of mine, Mr. Richard Clapton, and Down in the Lucky Country. Roll it, Bob. many times did I see that track played by a great band in front of a very enthusiastic audience. And no matter who he has playing in the band throughout the years, it's always been one of those really, really stellar groups of players. You can find, I do believe Richard's got a website. Used to be richardclapton.com.au. There's great tracks in there. Deep Water, which has been played on this program many moons ago. There's just tons. But anyway, and he's a bit of a legend now in Australian culture. So, okay. Now, Gene sent this thing to me. And for those of you that don't know, Gene actually is part of a book club that deals with peak oil. And so he's right into reading and researching the subject, and he sends quite a bit of stuff my way. And so he sent me this bit from OpenTheFuture.com, and it's peak oil versus global warming. This is interesting. Could we avoid the worst ravages of global warming because we run out of oil? Not since King Kong versus Godzilla have we seen a monster fight of this magnitude. Disaster versus disaster. Things fall apart versus the center cannot hold. Category apocalypse versus category apocalypse. Best of all, NASA's James Hansen serves as referee. In the first corner, we have peak oil, the premise that will soon, or perhaps already, have reached a maximum production of petroleum, and then the remaining reserves are far lower than generally acknowledged. The result, ever-rising fuel prices, global conflict over dwindling resources, and possibly even social and economic collapse if peak oil hits faster and harder than expected. Even the moderate case scenarios show declining petroleum access by the 2020s. The 2020s, that ain't long away. And while China and India are ramping up their up a car economy. In the second corner, we have global warming, the result of greenhouse gases, particularly CO2 from human sources, such as burning petroleum, trapping heat in the atmosphere. We're now at 385 parts per million and rising, up from 284 parts in the pre-industrial era. Climatologists generally consider 450 parts a tipping point to unrecoverable disaster, although there are now some signs that the already passed 350 parts per million would be a safer maximum. Among the actions required to avoid global warming disaster, a dramatic reduction in the consumption of fossil fuels. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the business-as-usual scenario, which posits that society keeps going as it has and fossil fuel consumption continues to grow at its current pace, result in an atmospheric CO2 concentration of over 950 parts per million by the end of this century. Anyone who looks at these figures and says that this is all just natural progression and does not look at the increases since the dawn of the industrial age has their head so far up their ass that if their eyes were blue, they'd be brown. I lost it. Where am I? Here we go. That's not likely to happen, of course. The effects of global warming, sea level rise, drought, pandemic disease, dog and cats living together, etc., would make such steady growth untenable. Technology change would play a role, too, as would shifts in population. But the biggest reason why it wouldn't happen is a simple one. There isn't enough petroleum in the ground in any form to make it possible. Now, this seems to be removing the coal factor, but hey. That's the argument that James Hansen and his colleague Pushkar A. Karicha, have no idea if I'm even close with that pronunciation, make in an article posed to the science website arxiv.org, A-R-X-I-V.org. I've been informed that the article went up about 6 months ago, but it hasn't received much attention. In implications of peak oil for atmospheric CO2 and climate, a PDF that's also downloadable at this link, all available on today's show post. Karicha and Hansen assert that the effort to keep atmospheric carbon levels below 450 parts per million may be greatly helped by basic limits on the amount of available oil. Because of peak oil forcing limits on petroleum consumption, a reasonable phase-out of coal, developed countries freeze their CO2 emissions from coal by 2012, and a decade later, developing countries similarly halt increases in coal emissions, between 2025 and 2050, it's assumed that both developed and developing countries will linearly phase out emissions of CO2 from coal usage. Active measurements to reduce non-CO2 forcings, including methane and black soot, and drawdown of CO2 through reforestation would limit CO2 to below 450 parts per million. This doesn't require the most aggressive peak oil scenarios either. Simply using the U.S. Energy Information Administration estimates of oil reserves is enough. Using more aggressive numbers, atmospheric CO2 peaks at 422 parts per million. Karicha and Hansen present five scenarios using a variety of estimates of peak oil timing and pace. Let's see. Peak oil emissions in the BAU scenarios occurs in 2016, plus or minus 2 years, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, if the year of peak is 2100, we'll hit 563 parts per million. That ain't going to happen. I don't think the petrol can ever even last that long. Not at costs that we can afford. The difference between Karicha and Hansen's business as usual and the other scenarios point to the importance of limiting coal and other greenhouse gases. I take back that coal comment from before. Peak oil isn't going to save us from global warming by itself. We still have to make major changes to how we live, how we build, how we generate energy, etc. All of the imperatives we've had to reckon with for a while. And peak oil itself, despite its global warming benefit, remains a real problem. While the doomer peak oil scenarios seem to me to be overwrought and simplistic, it's true that our society is thoroughly dependent upon fossil fuels, and an abrupt reduction in availability would be traumatic. As I noted in the big picture climate chaos, the intersection of global warming and peak oil means that we have overwhelming reason to move away from fossil fuels as energy sources as rapidly as possible, and that solutions in one area can help in another. It will be interesting to me to see how both peak oil watchers and anti-global warming activists take this report. I suspect that some oilers will dismiss it as not big news, since they already knew that society is going to collapse before we reach the worst of global warming. Others might take it as an indicator of trying to deal with peak oil by producing liquid coal fuels or similar fossil substitutes is a bad idea. Oh, yeah, we know it's a bad idea. And it would eliminate the one slight benefit of peak oil conditions. I hope that climate watchers might have a generally more positive response. This, I guess, is directed at me. Relief at the worst-case scenarios are even less likely than before. Unfortunately, I have a feeling that more than a few global warming-focused activists will see this report, despite coming from Hansen, as an attempt to reduce the urgency for a need to deal with arthenogenic carbon emissions. I don't see that at all. I don't see that at all, because the discussion also deals with the fact that coal needs to be phased out. It just needs to be phased out. Clean coal is a joke. It's a pipe dream that has very little chance of becoming a reality in the time frames that we need. He continues on. He says, what this report tells us, however, is that we can't simply focus on one crisis, no matter how large and looming, and I agree with this myself, without taking into consideration the other key drivers of change. The onset of peak oil will alter how we deal with climate disruption, rendering climate strategies that don't take peak oil into account of limited value. Similarly, the fact of global warming must shape how our economies deal with a permanent oil crunch. For both issues, the kind of strategies most likely to succeed are those based on the precepts of an open future, innovation and experimentation, transparency and shared knowledge, a collaboration and shared responsibility. It's a future worth fighting monsters for. And I couldn't agree more, and I have kind of, you know, been along the lines of looking at the whole picture. And with peak oil is just more reason to find ways to run transportation without fossil fuel. You know, if global warming isn't enough for you, the fact that the petroleum is going to disappear should be just positive reinforcement for the same strategies. And in fact, for them to be arced up for economic reasons. And this was written by Jaime Cascio, C-A-S-C-I-O, co-founder of WorldChanging.com, director of Impacts Analysis Center for Responsible Nanotechnology, fellow at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies Affiliate Institute for the Future. Guy's got quite a little bio there. So I think he might actually know what he's talking about. You know, I don't come out and just say things because I feel that is, you know, that it's the truth, so I spew it. I read it from the sources. I read it from people who are much better researched than I. I mean, I try to keep up on it. And God knows the ninjas and the listeners, you know, send me more stuff than I can keep up on, and I love every bit of it. And hey, I just got an email from Billy Shears. He liked that Richard Clapton track. I might have to send him a couple of others, and he can play them on Night Sounds at some point. I kind of thought he'd dig Ralphie. You know, this is just more reinforcement that we can't keep going the way we're going. Simple enough? Yeah, simple enough. let's see. What else do I have? Ah, here's another one from Texas Betsy. She sent some really good stuff today. And this comes out of Technology Review. This is a great website. MIT. A new kind of solar cell that is 27% more efficient without being more expensive to make. See, we were talking about this with Alan the Trucker yesterday, and how, you know, solar cells aren't as efficient as we'd like them to be, but as we continue to put more funding in, they're going to get more efficient and cheaper to manufacture as we go along. I don't think that this is the... I also saw a story about a way to inkjet print out solar cells. I haven't even had a chance to read that one yet. I'm dying to hear that one. Oh, but before I get into that in detail, News Ninja Susan is on the line. How you going, Susan? Welcome to the program.
Hi, Chad.
How are you?
I'm fine. I just wanted to mention... if you take a look around you, say your computers, your average emergency room, any hospital, basically our entire society, we can't wait for peak oil.
Right.
Because what do you want to wait? What do you want? You have to have a balance here. Do you want to run your automobile and heat your house, or do you want to use that plastic, that oil to make plastic for sterile IV tubing to maybe save your life?
Good point. Also, just along the lines of one of the themes in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, we have to be smart about the dirty resources that we have at the moment and use them in smart fashions to help develop the new technologies that we are going to need to get them up to speed so that then they can be used to continue to replicate those new technologies. So, yeah, we can't wait for peak oil. I totally agree. And that's what I think the Godzilla War article was referring to the fact that, yeah, you know, the oil might run out before we get to this high carbon point, but that is just more reason to change the way that we run society.
Now.
Yeah, now. Yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yeah, 1977, you know, Jimmy Carter, we should have been doing it. We should have been listening to that man then instead of ridiculing him.
Yeah. Reagan, I hope you're in hell.
Yeah, I still think that, you know, it is one of the most awful injustices in political history what was done to Jimmy Carter, because out of all ex-presidents, he has done more for humanity, more for society, more for people than any other living.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. He was a statesman
and
in every sense of the word.
You know, I was a very young chap at the time, and, you know, all I heard was, you know, he was a loser, got us in trouble. He was a fruitcake, couldn't run an economy, got us into an oil jam, and we needed Reagan. And, you know, I remember fist fights almost breaking out amongst 10 and 11-year-olds in a bus during the Carter-Reagan election.
Yeah.
And that's the effect of
He inherited
of
an economy
influence.
From the Republicans.
As always happens, as seems to always happen.
Oh, of course.
You know,
of course.
I mean, we're dealing with that here, but in the Australian version, you know, the previous government, right wing, you know, went full bore profit, 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 kiss up to business, tax cuts, tax cuts, and now the Labor government coming in is like having to go and pull the bloody brakes hard, and they have to deal with the mess of it being out of balance for so long. And, you know, Kevin Rudd's got a hell of a job ahead of him. And if he's able to rectify even half of it in his first term, he will go down in history as a political legend.
Yeah. I just hope we can elect somebody who's half as good.
I want to be a fly on the wall with his meetings. I want to be a fly on the wall in D.C. over the next couple of days so bad. As Rudd meets face-to-face with George Bush, this intellectual diplomat with a big heart who's a geek up against the jug-eared lunatic.
If we're lucky, Rudd will walk off with the keys to the United States and Australia will absorb us.
Well, you'll love this. This morning on the morning news program here, they have every Friday, they have their big hitters in politics, and they have one member of the Labor Party is a regular and one member of the Liberal Party is a regular, and they talk about stuff. And Kevin Rudd actually was the first one to do this when he was first elected as leader of the opposition, or even before he was even leader. And this is what started to give him his media branding. It did a great deal for bringing him into the spotlight. And so they were discussing Kevin Rudd going to the United States. And the little squirrely liberal actually has the audacity to say, you know, when asked, is there anything that you haven't heard being on the agenda that you hope he raises with George W. Bush? And this liberal, who came from the government that was completely in denial over the situation until it became a political hot potato, said, I hope he brings up global warming because it's so crucial to our future. And Tanya Plibersek, Tanya Plibersek, who is the labor minister for housing and water, I think it took all of her self-control not to just go, pwah, and just said, you know, I can't believe you have the gall to say that. After 11 years of government, so the follow-up question to him was, so you think he should tell the United States to sign Kyoto? And he begrudgingly said, well, yeah. And that was just another setup for the two hosts and Tanya to look at him like, You just idiot. How dare you? The entire country is going to see straight through that line of crap. And it's just the amazing audacity. Once in opposition, they turn around and go, I hope he brings up global warming and tells him to sign Kyoto. Meanwhile, John Howard stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder with George Bush going, we're not signing Kyoto for 11 years. It was just hysterical. Absolutely typical.
You have a really good night.
Thank you, darling, and don't forget about Earth Hour on Saturday, and thanks for calling in. Always love to hear from you.
You have a nice day. Bye-bye.
You too. Sorry. And that was Susan from up in Oregon, one of our mighty news ninjas who just, you know, and she runs the CenTab blog. We don't actually plug this enough. We have a great election blog. CENTAB.headonradionetwork.com, the central tabulator. And we kind of forget to mention her blog. And she just posts away, keeps tabs on what's going on with the races and does an absolutely wonderful job. And we're going to run a little over because we started a little late. And I'll save the solar cell article and try and find and maybe get into the other one next week. To mention about some of the